G'day World. 319. And to do something a little bit different, I thought we'd do a bit of a cam heart to heart while we listen to some new music from IOTA PromoNet. Sounds like Iggy Pop to me, but it's Bauhaus apparently. Just international bulletproof talent. I like it. Anyway, I thought it was time that we had a bit of a hard time. Let me turn the music down a bit so I can hear myself think. There we go. Keep it just in a nice little distance in the background there. So it's a long time since we've had a heart-to-heart. It's been mostly guests for the last couple of months. And I've been thinking about a lot of stuff, reading a lot of books, going through a lot of stuff at TPN headquarters. And, you know, I don't like to talk about myself, despite the rumours to the contrary. But every now and again, I like to have a bit of a heart-to-heart share with you. The first thing I want to talk about is the fact that I've recently got myself a performance coach. Or a life coach, as somebody described him today. I don't think of him as a life coach, just as a performance coach. Now, why, you might ask, do I need a performance coach? Well, you know, over the last 6 months, 12 months, I've felt that I wasn't really performing at my best, that I wasn't really achieving as much as I could be achieving in various aspects of my life. You know, what I'm doing with TPN is one of those, but there's also my health. I went to the doctor a while ago and I got a pretty bad cholesterol reading. I'm over all of the indicators for cholesterol and also some sort of hyperthyroid thing. But so obviously I need to take a lot better care of myself if I'm going to make it through to 2025 and Aubrey de Grey's immortality potions. But also, you know, just in terms of general things, I just felt that the workload was getting to me and I wasn't focusing on the most important issues as much as I could. So anyway, I was driving home from a meeting late one night a few weeks ago and I was listening to a podcast by TPN's own Tony Goodson, The Productivity Show, and he was interviewing a lady who's a performance coach, you know, for large organizations, and an author, an NLP type person. And I made a decision, that's it. I'm going to sort my shit out and I'm going to get help. I'm not doing a good job by myself. It's time that I got help. So I came home and I decided I wasn't going to go to bed that night until I had sort of lined up a couple of chats with performance coaches. And I Googled the shit out of it and I jumped on Twitter and asked if anyone had any recommendations and I shot off a few emails to a few people around the world whose focus and discipline I admire, a couple of guests that have been on Today World and people that I look up to. And by the end of that night, I had a couple of things lined up. So first thing I learned is that when you Google sort of performance coach on Google, funnily enough, on the web, you get all sorts of really, really bizarre, strange looking people who didn't look qualified at all, but had massive Google rank for some reason. You know, and you know, I don't mean to speak ill of massively overweight people. But, you know, if you're really, really, really overweight, saying that you're going to be my performance coach and help me take control of areas of my life where I'm not, you know, performing well, it just doesn't work for me. I'm sorry. Now I know that, you know, quite honestly, my performance coach doesn't need to be perfect and doesn't even need to be good at the things that I'm good at. But, you know, you need to show, I guess in my case anyway, I was looking for people that at least had the ability to demonstrate that they have their own self-discipline taken care of, let alone being able to help me with my self-discipline. Anyway, lots of just strange people that come up for some reason have good SEO. Anyway, so I chatted to a couple of people. There was one guy in Europe that I was talking to for a couple of weeks and a guy locally. and have decided for the time being to work with the local guy who came to me through a friend of mine. He's been great. I've been working with him sort of for the last week or so and having lots of early morning meetings, and is really already got me feeling a lot more focused and disciplined. And, I don't know about you guys, but I've read all the books and I've tried, GTD and all sorts of things over the years. But, there's something about, I guess one of the things about working for yourself and not, and particularly, I don't have a board of directors, I don't have VC investors, it's pretty much just me. And, it's kind of good to have someone that you sit down with on a regular basis and say, okay, here's what I'm going to achieve in the next day, week, month, quarter, and then have to live up to that, have to, get your shit together and focus. And if you guys have got a job or if you run your business and you have that kind of reporting structure that it's not just about keeping you honest, but gives you somebody to bounce ideas off and to sanity check your thinking and those sorts of things, I think it's a great thing. But what about in the other areas of your life where you don't have that? It might be your health. It might be you want to leave your job and go and do a startup or go and do a business, or maybe you want to do something creative, or there's some area of your life that you feel isn't really well-rounded, or is it really you don't feel fulfilled in at the moment and you want to get out, you want to do something extra. Well, I highly recommend going and looking for a coach, going and looking for somebody that can work with you to help you get through that. And I think in Australia, we still have a bit of a funny idea about this. I think Americans are a lot more comfortable with the idea of a coach than we are in Australia, and I suspect in Britain and New Zealand. But, I don't have any issue with it. It's the same way as I didn't have any issue when I was seeing a shrink for a few years. I mean, I figured that, shrinks are experts in helping you figure out why you think or feel the way that you do. And they're professionals with that. The same way that if your leg's not working properly, you go see a leg doctor. If you don't like the way your brain is working, you go see a brain doctor. I don't really understand why there's any social, concerns over that or issues, or why you wouldn't want to talk about that, or why you should be embarrassed about that. It just seems stupid to me. Anyway, so yeah, I'm excited about this. And, one of the things this guy's got me doing is getting up at 5:30 in the morning to start my day, which means obviously I need to get to bed about 10:30, 11 o'clock. Whoa. Hold on, got to turn this track down. He's the boy with the messy mind. It's hard to find the... I think this is Presidents of the United States. I love their stuff they used to do. Peaches. Because I like peaches. I eat lots of tinned peaches. The good ones, though, no sugar, just natural juice. Have them on my porridge in the morning. Apparently good for cholesterol. So to have porridge every morning, high fiber. Good for you, reducing your cholesterol, I've been told. So anyway, getting back to the performance coach thing. I don't have any issue with it. And he's got me getting up early in the morning, going to bed late at night, although I'm recording this at midnight now. But I don't have to get up early tomorrow because it's a Saturday. I'm recording this on a Friday night. But, getting up that hour in the morning is very unusual for me. Since I left Microsoft, I left my last real job mid-2004, what's that, 5, 6, 7, almost 4 years ago now, I pretty much get up when I wake up. I don't use an alarm clock, unless I'm catching a 6 a.m. flight, which I don't do very often anymore. But I tend to get up, when my kids get up and I have to take them to school. I'm normally getting up about 8:30, but I'm working usually up until 1 or 2 a.m. That's kind of my natural body clock. But this guy says, he reckons I need to get into a regular cycle and get up early in the morning. So I've been getting up early in the morning, doing 50 minutes of exercise on my cross trainer that I have at home. And, it's wearing me out, but I've kind of psychologically feel good about the fact that I'm getting up and getting that done. And sort of the theory, I think, is that when 9 o'clock comes in, I drop the kids at school and I sit down at the desk. I've already been up for a few hours. My heart's pumping. My mind is clear. I've eaten. I've had some coffee. I've done some exercise and I get stuck into the important stuff, whereas instead I'm sort of waking up still at that hour. But, you know, I think you guys should consider it. One of the other things that I've been doing, and I know some of you are going to laugh at this, I've been listening to an Anthony Robbins tape pack. Now, I don't know what you think of Anthony Robbins, but I remember reading his early books, Unlimited Power and Awaken the Giant Within, I think, back in my very early 20s when I was working dead-end bullshit desk jobs for companies like Citibank or Ford Credit, or, you know, and I hated my jobs and I hated my life typically, and I was earning no money and I had no education and no contacts, no network, no ideas. But I remember reading these books and what he talked about made a lot of sense to me. Now, the whole hyped up American seminar firewalking thing doesn't sit well with me, as you can probably gather. But when you listen to this guy talk on his tape packs or you read his books, it actually, for me anyway, makes a lot of sense. He used to do NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, and he now calls what he's doing neuro-associative conditioning. And essentially, as I understand it from listening to this relatively recent tape pack, I think, which is Personal Power 2, I think, if you're wondering. Some people have asked me, because I tweeted about it or something. He basically says, if there are things in your life that you think you should be doing, but you're not doing, and you don't seem to be able to get yourself to do them. Again, it might be something that's work-related, business-related, relationships, losing weight, quitting smoking, whatever. If you know you should be doing it, but you're not doing it, or you want to be doing it, but you're not doing it, it's because somewhere inside of your brain, you have associated doing that thing with some form of pain, or you've associated doing the opposite of that thing with some sort of pleasure. So in my case, the thing that I really don't like doing is sales calls. Cold calling, you know, the sales part of ad sales, which happens to be where we make all of our money at TPN, I really don't like. I'm really uncomfortable doing that kind of stuff. Probably because I hate it when people call me and try and sell me stuff. And when I'm doing those calls, I'm putting myself on the other side of the phone, if you know what I like. So I associate that with pain, even though I know I have to do it, and I know I can do it, and I'm pretty good at it when I do it. I tend to find any other thing to do that I can do. There's so many parts of running TPN that I really enjoy, but that's not one of them. And you know, I get 200 emails a day, I get 20 voicemails a day, people trying to call me, people wanting to have meetings. I can easily be really, really busy from dawn till dusk. And it's all legitimate stuff. It's stuff that's good. It's good for TPN. It's important stuff. But, you know, there are certain things that are more important than others. And so, you know, part of the Tony Robbins thing is figuring out what it is about this activity that you have conditioned yourself to feel about it, and then changing that conditioning. And he has a whole bunch of methods and techniques for changing those neural connections in your brain. So instead of associating that activity with something bad, you associate it with something good, and then you're more likely to go and do it. Anyway, I highly recommend it. I've really been enjoying his tape pack. I'm going to confess to it. You can call me a weirdo if you like, but I've really, really been getting a lot out of it and enjoying it. So there you go. That's my second confession. I got a performance coach, and I've been listening to Tony Robbins' tape packs. The third thing that's really been interesting to me lately is I've been reading a book on Carl Jung and his dreams and symbolism. Now, I've always felt that this whole dream analysis thing was bullshit and bunk, and whenever I hear people talking about their dreams and what their dreams mean, I've always basically shot them down and said, yeah, it's just a bunch of chemicals, you know, bumping into each other when you're asleep. Don't get excited, you know. But yeah, I've started to change. Now, a couple of things have changed my perspective on this. Number one, well, the reason I bought this book on Jung recently, by the way, the book I'm reading is, hold on, I've got to reach over and get it. It's called Man and His Symbols, conceived and edited by Carl Jung. It was apparently, there's a number of chapters in here. Jung wrote the first one, and a lot of his sort of students or followers wrote the rest of the chapters. And it's the last thing that he did before he died. He wrote this chapter, he approved all of the other chapters, and then he died sort of in the 60s or early 70s, I think. 1961, he died. There you go. Looking in the front page of the book. Now, I've met a lot of people that I really respect over the last year. A lot of them are sort of, I've met via Peter Elliard, surprisingly enough. Or not surprisingly enough. Oh, hold on, we're running out of music. I better put some more music on. Hold on. Okay, we're back. Yeah, via Peter Elliard's sort of circle of friends. And a lot of people have said to me, oh, you need to... We were having discussions over lunch or dinner and I don't know. Somehow the conversation always comes back to Carl Jung. And people have said to me, oh, you need to read Carl Jung. You would love Jung. You need to get into it. So that was the first thing. Then the other thing that's changed my thinking around this is Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, which I started reading... a few months ago. Didn't finish that. Don't know where it is. I think it's packed in one of my boxes because, as some of you will know, I'm moving from Melbourne to Brisbane in a couple of weeks. And, you know, what Gladwell basically talks about in Blink is that the things that we call intuition or gut feeling, these conclusions that we come to about people or situations or decisions that we make that don't seem to have a clearly logical framework behind them. We just have this strong feeling that we should go in a particular direction or handle a situation in a certain way. What his explanation for that is that, you know, our brains take in massive amounts of data and information in any given day and obviously over the course of our lives. And a lot of that gets stored, but it's stored in our subconscious. And our conscious mind is very good at focusing on a small number of things at any one time. And that's a very useful trick. And we do the newer parts of our brain, the sort of prefrontal cortex, do a very good job at that. But there's a whole bunch of information that they just can't process in that way, because if they did, the circuits would fry out. And the way that that represents itself to us during our waking life is through this thing called intuition. And he's basically saying in this book that we should learn to understand what that is. And in the West, we've kind of been taught not to trust those things, that we should only trust, you know, a logical framework of decision making. When he's saying that these things can actually quite often be very, very accurate. They can also lead us astray in a lot of times as well. And in his book, he sort of demonstrates both scenarios. Anyway, so I guess this is basically what Jung seems to be saying in this book that I'm reading, is that our dreams are the same thing, but in our sleep. It's all of this information that the brain has captured, and it's talking to you, I guess. It's your subconscious mind talking to your conscious mind while you're asleep. I'm not sure if you're literally conscious when you're asleep, but you know what I'm saying. But it does it not in a very clear, logical fashion. It presents situations to you in this kind of dream language, this symbolism, this mythology, and what these symbols mean to you are different from person to person based on your upbringing and your experiences. And, you know, if I see a dolphin in my dream, it might mean one thing to me and it might mean something completely different to somebody else, which is apparently the whole point of dream analysis, is working with, you know, somebody who understands a bit about this to figure out what these things mean to you. But this whole concept that dreams are really your subconscious talking to you, feeding you back information about things that have happened in your day or happened recently to you, is interesting to me. I mean, I'm not sure if I would necessarily think that this information being spewed back out by your brain is necessarily a guide that you should follow, or if it's just something that you should try and understand, that your brain is processing all of this data, spitting something back out, and maybe just factor it into our decision-making capabilities. Now, personally, I don't dream very often, or if I do, I don't remember dreaming very often. Very, very occasionally, I will be aware of dreaming or will wake up in the morning and say, wow, I had a weird dream last night. But 99% of the time, I just am not aware of dreams. I just don't seem to dream. I don't know if it's because my sleeping patterns are really screwed up or what it is, but I just don't tend to have any experience of dreaming anyway. But I'd be interested to know if you guys do. I mean, I know people that have some really crazy dreams. My wife, Belinda, has, on a nightly basis, really, really obscure, bizarre, weird dreams. What else are we going to... Oh, the other book that I'm reading at the moment is a book on Marx and Engels, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. Obviously, the fathers of modern communism and socialism. And the authors of the Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital and many other books. Now, as some of you will know, I've become increasingly interested in the last few years in revolutionaries and what they've done and why they did what they did. You know, I've read a number of books on Castro and Che Guevara, and obviously, you know, Napoleon I consider a revolutionary in a way, I guess. I've read a lot about the French Revolution. You know, I've read a lot about Chomsky's views on social anarchy and social revolution. But I'd never actually read anything by Marx. So I got this book, and it's sort of a collection of writings by Marx and Engels. It's quite old. I think this book's probably came out in the 50s, I think. But it's fascinating to me to, you know, get at the core of what these guys were saying. But the interesting thing from my perspective is, you know, up until a few years ago, I considered myself a pretty right-wing laissez-faire capitalist and had been my entire adult life. I was pretty much as right as you could get without becoming a complete fascist. And, you know, if somebody had suggested to me 10 years ago that I read a book by Marx or even by Chomsky, I would have, you know, snorted derisively at them and would have said things like, well, communism failed, you know, socialism's a failure, communism's a failure, just look at countries X, Y, and Z. The Soviet Union is a classic one. And I've had a number of people say these things to me in recent times, and my perspective is completely different on these things now. I was having lunch with a good friend of mine up in Sydney yesterday, a couple of good friends of mine actually, and I mentioned that I was talking this, and this guy said exactly the same thing. Oh, you know, the Soviet Union failed. The problem with communism, this is a great line, you hear this a lot. The problem with communism, you know what the big problem with communism is? It's fine on paper, it's fine in theory, but you know what the big problem is? People. And I said, well, that's probably true, but you know what the big problem with capitalism and democracy is? People. You know, it's very clear to me, I don't know about you guys, but it's very clear to me that the American form of democracy and capitalism that we all grew up with as being, you know, sort of the bastion of civilization is starting to crack at the seams. Now, that's not to say that it's wrong or it's bad or it's worse than other political systems out there, but it's not flawless, it's not imperfect, and I think we're starting to see the problems inherent in it, you know, obviously in the last 8 years under the Bush regime, but I think, you know, anyone who's read anything about the way that the United States has conducted its foreign politics post-World War II understands that, you know, it's seriously, seriously corrupted and flawed. I'm reading a great book at the moment that Nick Hodge gave me, I think, for my birthday last year, bought for me, which I think he's read. I remember catching him reading it in Starbucks or something last year. It's called The Legacy of Ashes. It's the history of the CIA, written by, I think, a reporter from the New York Times. And it's, you know, it's fascinating, basically saying that the entire history of the CIA has been just been one clusterfuck after another, just complete string of disasters. The only real success they ever had was funding and supporting and training the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight off the Russians in the late 70s and early 80s. But of course, out of that, out of that came, you know, Al-Qaeda and the strength of the Taliban in many ways, which is now causing America all sorts of headaches. So it was a short-term success, but long-term, it was, a major fuck-up for them. But you look at the way that the CIA has been involved in toppling the governments in Latin American, African, and Asian countries to put in their puppet dictators who will, you know, give them what they want, which is basically financial hegemony in these countries. You know, there's just a long, long history of this, primarily, you know, sort of post-World War II. And, you know, the way that they run the United Nations Security Council and the World Bank and the IMF to suit their particular needs of for profit are pretty disgraceful and pretty destructive to the world as a whole. So yeah, it's fascinating to me to, you know, to get to the core of what Marx and Engels were suggesting. And I'm not going to put myself forward as an expert on this stuff by a long means, but yeah, you know, I guess the thing that's most interesting for me is as I'm reading it, a lot of this conditioning that I've received growing up in a country like Australia and watching a lot of American television, reading a lot of American literature over the last 30 odd years about how communism is bad, socialism is bad, communism fails, socialism is corrupt, and you know, capitalism, you know, and I'm a big fan of Ayn Rand, as some of you will know, the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, and she was obviously very, very anti-communism and altruism at any level, very, very pro the rights of the individual and capitalism. But, you know, I think it's fairly easy to see that, yes, whilst the experiments around the world with communism and socialism in the last century may have had their problems, so has capitalism. You know, capitalism, you know, look at the healthcare system in the United States versus the healthcare system in Cuba, for a good example. Oh, the healthcare system in France. Those of you that have seen Michael Moore's film Sicko know what I'm talking about. So we live in a very different time today, and I think, you know, we need to find a new system. And it might be, you know, what we have in Australia, a socialist democracy where we have capitalism, but we also have taxation, and we have a welfare system, and we have, you know, a quasi-free healthcare and quasi-free education and these sorts of things, which is, you know, basically what socialism is, the government providing a bunch of services for the people to make sure that their basic needs are taken care of. But we still have capitalism, and we still have the freedoms that we enjoy in a democracy. But, you know, the problems that we have in a democracy and in a capitalism are ones where you get the people that, you know, the new nobility that just have such a huge amount of capital that they can corrupt most of the institutions in the country, including the government, including the media, including corporations and law. You know, the legal system is corrupt. You know, it's easy to corrupt. Whether or not it is, I can't say, you know, but we have lots of examples of, you know, judges and lawyers being bought. So, yeah, you know, I don't think it makes any sense to have a simple ideology that says capitalism good, communism bad. I think we need to start thinking about what's the next way forward. What's the new way forward? Now that we have the net, you know, increasingly people are connected to the net via all different means, and, you know, we need to figure out what this digital democracy looks like. I'm actually reading a book too on the Russian Revolution, written by Abramovich, who was took part in the Soviet Revolution of 1917. He was a Menshevik, which was you know, the sort of minority party in the communist part of the revolution versus Lenin's Bolsheviks, and it's fascinating too looking at the, you know, sort of the history of the Russian Revolution, which, again, I know very little about. Kind of embarrassed that I know so little about it. You know, it had such a big impact on the 20th century. One of the things I was fascinated in reading this book to learn was that when the revolution actually happened, none of the leaders of the revolution were even in the country. They had all been in exile in places like Switzerland for a decade. And, in fact, like, 3 or 4 days before the revolution kind of happened in Russia, Lenin was giving a speech to university students, I think, in Switzerland, where he was saying the revolution in Russia wouldn't happen in his lifetime. They just thought the conditions for it weren't there. It was so far off, it was never going to happen. But it kind of it was a leaderless revolution. You know, Russia was hurting early into World War One. They had had a very, very, their army had had a very, very significant defeat at the hands of the Germans. And, you know, the Tsar's, Nicholas was, you know, didn't have a lot of popular support. His queen was mucking around with Rasputin, who everyone hated, all the people hated Rasputin. And they just had no support. And then sort of the army was demoralized, people were demoralized, and basically people just went out on strike right across the country, almost autonomously. Factories and Soviets, which were like basically unions, just started going on strike right across the country and refusing to go to work. And the king sent in the army to basically, you know, stop these strikes and to force them to go back to work, because they're in the middle of a war, right? When things are pretty fragile. And the army basically, you know, sat down with the Soviets, with the unions, and said, nah, screw you. And then the crazy thing was, Lenin and all the leaders of the revolution needed to get back in a hurry. Oh, we've run out of music again. Oh, I can't be bothered putting it on. They all had to get back quickly to Russia to say, well, you know, it's kind of like, I'm their leader, don't let them leave without me kind of deal. And they had to get back through Germany, where they had to come back via the front of World War One to get back into Russia. And some great stories around that. But, you know, fascinating stuff just for me to learn about the conditions of them. And finally, as you know, I run out of time here, I just wanted to give you a short sort of heart-to-heart. What are you doing, guys? Seriously, with your lives? I mean, I've been harassing you for over 3 years now about taking control of your lives and getting out of this corporate rat race bullshit. And I don't care what kind of justifications you've got for it. That, oh, I like my job, or, oh, I've got a mortgage and kids in school I can't afford. You know, it just doesn't wash. I'm sorry. I mean, we need you to be doing something productive, creative, constructive, to take control of the direction this planet is going in. I don't know if you've noticed, but a lot of shit's going bad on this planet right now. And, you know, you can't just sit there and say, well, somebody else will take care of it, because, no, they really aren't gonna. You know, you really don't want your politicians and your corporate leaders setting the agenda for the rest of this century, folks. You know, I've met a lot of these people, and they're not really bright people, I got to tell you. They're not really the sort of people I'm comfortable putting the fate of the human race, the fate of my kids' lives, in the hands of. I'm not sure you guys are either, but this, you know, seriously, we need to get out there, and it's a responsibility, is the way that I think of it. You know, you shouldn't think about leaving a job necessarily in terms of, well, I want to make more money, or I want to have more control of my life, or that sort of thing. Although, you know, there's nothing wrong with those motivations, and I hope they all do come true for you. But it's got to be a sense of responsibility about, you know, you're smart. I've seen the surveys of who you are. I know my audience relatively well. You're very intelligent. You're very active people in a range of things. You're early adopters. You're smart. You guys particularly know how to use online tools, digital technology, better than 99% of the population. And this is the platform, right, for digital democracy. This is the platform for us to subvert the traditional control mechanisms that the wealthy have been using for thousands of years to control the proletariat, the bourgeoisie controlling the proletariat. We now have this amazing, unbelievable platform called the net, the web, that we can use to subvert all of these things. But somebody needs to step up and take control. And I'm still, you know, so sick of seeing people in the valley, and all they're interested in is, you know, making $1 billion and buying a Ferrari. That seems to be what they get out of bed for, rather than think, how can I use my knowledge, my skills, my experience, my contacts to make the world a better place using this stuff? And I just would love to see more of you do it. You know, I reckon in the 3 years I've been harassing people about this, I can probably count on one hand the people I know, my friends and people who listen to this show, who have stepped out and really taken the bit between their teeth. And I don't know, it's kind of disappointing to me, folks, and I'm not seeing you more, not seeing more of you do it. I'm not seeing more of you jump out and have a crack at a startup or get involved in some sort of social activism. I'm sure if you would, you'd be telling me about it. You know, I'd love to cover it on the show, but I don't know, what are you doing? Is it just that you don't care? I was at Modem in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago, and I was sitting down with a couple of guys, young guys before Modem, and I was dressed in my khaki gear, my camo gear, as my kids call it. And these guys made some sort of joking reference to my camo, and I started talking half-jokingly about, well, yeah, I'm getting people ready for a revolution. We need to march on Canberra. It's armed revolution time. And I think I seriously freaked these guys out. But one of them was saying to me, you know, I'm pretty happy with the way things are in this country. I think it's pretty good. I said, well, absolutely. You know, this is a great country. I mean, you know, in terms of quality of life, it's probably easily the best country on the planet, or at least one of the best countries on the planet. But, you know, we're still responsible for a lot of bad shit that's going on, not just in other parts of the world, but also in this country. You think about the situation with the Indigenous Australians, etc. You know, Kevin Rudd's apology aside, there's a lot of bad stuff that goes on, and somebody needs to take control of that. And, you know, Liberal, Labor, Republicans, Democrats, really it's all the same thing, right? Don't get trapped into this illusion that there are different parties here with different, you know, really different motivations. At the end of the day, you know, it's rich white guys and a handful of rich white women that are pretty much running things. And, you know, one rich white guy pretty much wants the same things as the next rich white guy. You know, Kevin Rudd is a millionaire, thanks in large part to his wife's business. Malcolm Turnbull is a rich white guy. Let's forget about Brendan Nelson. But do you really think that Kevin Rudd and Malcolm Turnbull want essentially different things? I think pretty much not. They pretty much want the same things. And they have the same, you know, corporate interests that they need to kowtow to. They have the same you know, lobby groups that they need to kowtow to maintain their power. At the end of the day, the same strings are being pulled. It's just a different hat. And we are all led to believe that we have some sort of choice. It's the same in the US with the whole republic. Do you really think Obama or Clinton, if they become president, is going to be any different to McCain? You know, there's going to be some marginal differences around the edges, but it's like, you can have Diet Coke or you can have Coke Zero. You know, it's pretty much, you might have a different form of saccharin in there. It's a different form of artificial sweetener, but at the end of the day, it's basically the same thing. For my money, maybe Diet Coke or Pepsi. That's your choice. Diet Coke or Pepsi, which one do you want? Anyway, it's a bit of my rant. I just want to see more of you guys getting off your asses and participating in the revolution. You know, it doesn't have to be my revolution either. Obviously, you don't all think the way I think or believe in the things that I believe in. But, you know, we need you out there. We need all hands on deck right now. The human race is... This is it, folks. This is the last century of the human race. I'm fairly convinced. And, you know, you can have a discussion about whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's not so much the human race that I'm so concerned about. It's the prospect of intelligence. You know, it strikes me that the universe is 14 point something billion years old, and as far as we know, the human race is the current high point of an intelligent species in the universe. Now, there may be others out there. We don't know that, though, for sure. We can't take any chances here. It could be just us. The Green Bank equation that Carl Sagan and a bunch of guys came up with at Green Bank, New Jersey in the late 50s, early 60s, there's this long formula that basically designed to figure out what are the odds that there is intelligent life coexisting with us in the universe. And depending on the variables that you stick into that equation, there can either be a lot or there can be none. It could just be us. And let's err on the side of caution. Let's say it's just us. And let's say that we fuck it up this century. And either through
thermonuclear warfare or through, you know, fucking up the basic environment, we kill ourselves out. Or we don't even have to kill ourselves out. We just set ourselves back 1,000 years. You know, that could be it for intelligent life in this universe. You know, we don't know how long we've got until the next meteorite hits this planet. We don't know how long we've got until a metavolcano like Yellowstone National Park explodes and shoots up enough ash and dust to block out all sunlight for 1,000 years. You know, these are things that have happened over the history of the Earth on a very, very regular basis. If any of you read Bill Bryson's book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, you'll have got that point as I did. It's quite terrifying how often in the 5 billion year history of this planet these things have happened. And when they happen, you know, the majority of life gets wiped out. Dinosaurs walking around for 200 million years. Humans, Homo sapiens, have been here for 2 million. They were here 100 times longer than us and they were wiped out. Yellowstone National Park, I think, erupts every 600,000 years, a massive sort of metavolcano eruption. And I think it's currently about 60,000 years overdue. Now, we don't know when. We know that the water levels are rising. We don't know when it's going to blow next. We need to hurry the fuck up. And instead of, you know, the US's defense budget this year is going to be over $1 trillion for the first time. Instead of investing that in buying new nukes when they've already got 10,000 active warheads, you know, what about investing that into artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, curing cancer, taking care of poverty, setting up a global government, a one-world government, setting up digital democracy, doing things that are going to progress the advancement of the human race, and therefore, hopefully, intelligence and wisdom across this planet, rather than just, you know, edging us closer to wiping ourselves out and potentially wiping out a 14.7 billion year experiment that the universe then needs to start all over again. You know, we have a responsibility here, folks, you and me, to step up and do whatever we can do. I mean, I feel very helpless sometimes, but at least I got to go to my bed every night thinking that I'm doing everything that I can do to change things. Speaking of changing things, those of you that have read the blog this week will know that I'm very excited about the fact that Peter Elliard's latest book, Designing 2050, is, we've got the first proof copies of that published by TPN Text, and that's going to go on sale in the next couple of weeks online. It will be advertising it across TPN. It'll also be in some bookstores around Australia, but primarily going to sell it online. And I'm very excited about it. This is an absolutely magnificent book. It's massive. I read the manuscript and I've been reading through the proof again. It's mind-bending how much he's crammed into this book. It's basically about all of the different things that the human race needs to think about as we chart our course through the next 50 years. And he's built an incredible vision. And it's everything from the environment and sustainable living through to different forms of business ideas and economies, through to retraining workforces, through to the new political systems that we need, through to, you know, globalization movement, whether that's good or bad. And you know, it's just a massive book, and really, really proud I am to be associated with it in a very small way. He's an absolute treasure, Peter Elliard, and I am very honored to be his friend and to be involved in this sort of stuff. So look for that when it gets plugged across TPN in the next couple of weeks. Anyway, this is Cameron out. Going to leave you with a track that I've been playing a little bit of in the background. I'm going to play it full steam. This is International Bulletproof Talent by Bauhaus. Talk to you soon, kids. Have a good one. Do something with your life. Fallout boy, no hope.
national bulletproof talent. International bulletproof talent. National bulletproof.